enormous expectations on the part of the Labour Party that they will be significantly better treated and welcomed by the EU, because precisely they are not the Conservatives. But the reality is that the European Union has very little interest in changing the current trade and cooperation agreement. The areas where the UK has hopes of being able to use leverage to achieve a better deal is defence and security. But there, the whole point of the European effort is to increase strategic independence from the United States.
Hello, I'm Brendan Donnelly. I'm the director of the Federal Trust, and I'll be talking today with the chair of the Federal Trust, John Stevens, about the course of the general election, the results, and particularly the implications of those results for relations between the United Kingdom and the European Union. John, there was a lot of comment about the absence of Brexit from the debate during the general election campaign. Do you agree with that commentary? And if so, why do you think it happened, or why didn't it happen?
Well, it was certainly true that Brexit was the ghost at the feast. And it's hardly surprising, I suppose, because the major parties didn't have any real interest to discuss it. The Conservative Party, obviously, because Brexit is now widely seen as having been a disaster, didn't want to go back over that territory. The Labour Party felt that the priority to win was to recapture the votes which it lost to Boris Johnson in 2019 in the so-called Red Wall. And the key to that was not talking about Brexit, and certainly not suggesting in any way that they might seek to mitigate it or reverse it to any degree. And the Liberal Democrats were targeting initially their former heartland in the southwest of England, which was a Leave area overwhelmingly in the 2016 referendum, and therefore felt that it wasn't in their political interests to talk about Brexit at all. And they'd also calculated that their target seats in the southeast of England, in the Blue Wall, where there were quite a number of Conservatives who voted Remain in the referendum, that it was too complex a picture in terms of Conservative opinion, and that they were better off not going on a more pro-European message. Although the other overriding objection that they would have been inconsistent between the two was not actually a problem that has detained the Liberal Democrats in the past.
So those are the main three parties. A lot of surprise was caused by Starmer's remark at the end of the campaign that he couldn't imagine the United Kingdom rejoining the EU during his lifetime. Not clear whether it was his physical or political lifetime. Why do you think he said that? That seemed to mark a ramping up, perhaps an unnecessary ramping up of the position that he'd adopted until then.
Well, I think it was due to a loss of nerve, because his polling experts were telling him that the intervention by Nigel Farage and the increase in the profile of Reform, that was cutting into the Labour vote. And there's no question that Reform voters, Reform after all came third in terms of the share of the vote in the general election, came almost as much from the Labour Party, Labour voters, as it came from Conservative ones. I mean, in a sense, Farage's intervention, his comeback and determination to be a candidate did raise the profile of the Brexit issue, because Farage is very much identified with that. Because the irony is that Farage himself didn't really want to talk about Brexit either, because it is widely perceived. Nearly 70% of public opinion recognise that Brexit has been a mistake. So he focused exclusively on immigration. So you had a situation where everybody effectively had a vested interest of one kind or another in evading the largest issue in British politics, namely our relationships with the European Union.
Do you think that Starmer's remark towards the end of the campaign is going to affect in the short term the course of the development of EU-UK relations. How do you see those relations as working out over the next couple of years? Will there, for instance, be frustration on the Labour side if they find that they're not going to get much in the way of purchase from simply not being the Conservative Party when they deal with the Commission and Council in Brussels?
But it's certainly true there are enormous expectations on the part of the Labour Party that they will be significantly better treated and welcomed by the EU because precisely they are not the Conservatives. But the reality is that the European Union has very little interest in changing the current trade and cooperation agreement. The areas where the UK has hopes of being able to use leverage to achieve a better deal is defence and security. But there, the whole point of the European effort is to increase strategic independence from the United States and to build up their own armaments industries with European taxpayers' money. And the idea that Britain can present either an answer to the problem of the reliability of the United States as a strategic player in European defence. I mean, Britain is seen to be, correctly, in my view, essentially an adjunct of United States military power, if you look at the nuclear deterrent, but also if you look at our special forces and things. And so it doesn't answer this question of European strategic independence from America. And then in terms of Britain's hopes of having a whole range of side deals on free movement of students or whatever, this is contrary to the EU's profound desire not to go down that path again. And you see that their desire to avoid any form of such arrangements in their current treatment of the Swiss. So the hopes that the Labour Party have vis-a-vis the European Union seem to be based on two very fundamental misunderstandings of the European position.
Will this even lead to friction in a couple of years' time?
Well, I think it's quite likely that having tried on the basis that they're not the Conservative Party to be given a warm welcome and not receive one, there will be a certain amount of irritation and scepticism. But all this will be dominated by what happens in the United States. I think a Trump presidency will exacerbate all these problems because there will be a suspicion that Britain will, whatever its misgivings may be about a Trump presidency and its implications for domestic democracy in America, that they will nevertheless go along with Trump. And David Lammy was in Washington ahead of before the general election and gave every indication that he was keen to talk with people close to Trump and work with Trump.
The United Kingdom might be seen as a Trojan horse, as somebody once said.
Exactly. I mean, and this goes right back to the position that Tony Blair took over Iraq and everything. So the European suspicions are very high, and the hurdle for the Labour Party to be able to overcome in order to persuade the Europeans that they are really committed now towards getting closer to Europe, I think are really beyond them.
That's the left of the British political spectrum, as it were. How do you see the right developing in the United Kingdom over the next couple of years? And obviously, attitudes to Europe will be central to and emblematic of that, that internal strife, which we may reasonably expect within the Conservative Party.
Well, here I think the problem is again dominated by what happens in America, because I think a Trump presidency will vastly increase the power that Nigel Farage has because of his personal connections with Trump, and will colour a large part of opinion on the right of British politics in the Conservative Party, and will, I think, make it much more likely that he is able to achieve some form of takeover of the Conservative Party. The now, if that doesn't happen, then I think the field may be somewhat more open, because it is quite clear that a large body of conservative leading opinion, there are very few politicians who would be able to address this audience, but conservative leading opinion, particularly in business, is very keen for a reconnection with the European Union. This is particularly true of manufacturing industries, but more generally, I would say. And they at the moment have no plausible political representation. I don't think it is credible for the Liberal Democrats to be able to fulfill that function, and for there to be a split in the Conservative Party, therefore, with a large body of it going to Reform and to Farage, and but another body going into some form of pro-European centre-right connection with the Liberal Democrats, because the Liberal Democrats themselves are, in terms of policy, to the left of the Labour Party, but more that although they've achieved this astonishing score in terms of seats, their vote share is virtually unchanged. In fact, it's less than it was at the last general election.
But in
So,
quite fact, quite a lot of people who voted Liberal Democrat were voting for a Labour government because they wanted to get out the Conservative in their particular constituency.
that again is true. So I think the idea that, which is certainly entertained by some pro-European conservatives, most of whom are no longer in the Conservative Party now, that there might be some basis of recreating a sort of Orange Book style link to the Liberal Democrats as a response to reform and a way of preserving a centre-right pro-European cause, I think is probably misplaced at the moment. Just to go back to the Labour Party, I mean, and talking about Reform's impact on the Labour Party, I mean, one has to remember that Reform has now got 87 seats in which it is in second place to the Labour Party, and I think that that is going to be a further restraint on the capacity for a Labour government to move in a more pro-European direction.
Well, the counter argument to that is that economic circumstances and perhaps the development in this country, in the United Kingdom, of even more hostility to Brexit in a couple of years' time will lead to a combination of forces that might oblige Starmer and the Labour Party to adopt a more Eurocentric, a more friendly attitude towards the European Union, because we've canvassed the possibility that disappointment about the initial, probably rebuff or insufficient acceptance from Brussels may lead to frictions with the Labour Party, but it could also lead to a re-evaluation of Starmer's red lines and the idea that you can't get too close to Europe. Do you see that as being a plausible possibility in a couple of years' time?
I'm absolutely certain that disenchantment with Brexit is only going to increase. And this full scale of the disaster that it is bringing to the British state and to the British economy and to British culture becomes more and more apparent. And I think that there will be a very strong body of opinion, particularly associated with business, which will want to see the issue addressed. The problem is that it's not clear what the political voice for this disenchantment and this pressure will be, because it will be opening up divisions within the Labour Party. I said that the reform is a challenge to a section of the Labour Party's vote and Labour Party support, but equally there will be elements in the Labour Party which are very strongly pro-European. But whether they are able to find a voice within the umbrella of the current Labour government is a very open question, and it's not clear where the voice will be on the other side, to the right of the spectrum, because of the problems that we've already alluded to in turning the Liberal Democrats into anything other than what they are at the moment, which is a protest movement that has benefited from exceptional circumstances to win a large number of seats, but has not actually achieved a very large level of actual support in votes in the election.
Can we talk a bit about the implications of the election, and particularly as related to Brexit, for the non-English parts of the United Kingdom, Scotland and Northern Ireland in particular? The Scottish National Party did very badly. And there are those who draw the conclusion from that that independence is at best postponed for many, many years, and at worst, or best, depending on your point of view, off the agenda entirely. What do you think about that analysis?
Well, it was certainly a very serious defeat for the Scottish National Party. And the reasons for that are fairly clear. They've had two appalling leaders, and their conduct of government in Scotland, dealing with Scottish affairs, has been pretty appalling. But that has not actually altered the level of support in Scottish opinion for independence, which remains locked at about 50%, where it has been placed by Brexit having overturned what would have been a clear decision in 2014 in favour of retaining the United Kingdom. So independence remains an open issue. Now, it may well be if the political eclipse of the Scottish National cause in the form of the Scottish National Party continues, will the call for independence fade, or will it find some other outlets? And that, which is a rather alarming thought. But for that issue, the crucial elections are not actually these ones in for Westminster. They are the elections in 2 years' time for the Scottish Parliament. And it remains to be seen whether this disaster for the SNP leads them to change leaders again. I think it probably will, and whether they are able to then re-establish themselves in order to make a credible showing in those elections. And that remains open. I think that
The
they
eclipse of the SNP has not led to any decline in anti-Brexit sentiment, has it, in Scotland?
well, quite the contrary, actually. I mean, one of the features of this campaign, I mean, Scotland was about the only place where Brexit was actually extensively discussed, because it was something which the SNP were pointing out on several occasions. And support for rejoining the EU in Scotland is near 70%. And so it's a very strange situation. You have 30% support, or perhaps less, for the Scottish National Party. You have 50% support for independence and 70% for rejoining the EU. And it's not quite clear what the meaning of that is. What it does mean, I think, is that the Labour Party's victory in Scotland is a fragile one, because as long as that opinion towards the EU remains intact, Labour's and Labour is on the present course of essentially being a pro-Brexit party, wanting to make Brexit work in the United Kingdom as a whole, then that is a very clear path towards early disappointment by Scottish voters with the Labour Party.
What about Northern Ireland? Do you think the situation has been much changed by the general election, or has it just reflected changes that were already in place?
Well, I think what has happened is that the unionist cause has fragmented. We've seen the DUP lose to both an extreme unionist, the TUV, of the defeat of Ian Paisley Jr., and to the UUP, who won a seat from them. So that the unionist political family has been fragmented further, and the nationalist voters held up. So you've had a further lurch, I suppose, in a national direction, but one which is really predicated by the loss of credibility of political unionism. And that, of course, is a danger, because it potentially opens the path to more extremist elements who are discontented with the arrangements of the Trade and Cooperation Agreement and the Windsor Framework that's attached to it, creating a border in the Irish Sea. But what will really determine the significance of that will be what happens in the Irish Republic in their elections, which are due in the autumn, and whether Sinn Féin is able to be the largest party there and indeed form a government or not. And at the moment, that doesn't look so likely, but it's a very open situation. Were that to be the case, and you were to have questions of a border poll back on the issue, that would be a very difficult situation for Keir Starmer and the Labour government, because they will be torn between the requirements of peace in Northern Ireland, stability in Northern Ireland, and trying to get closer to the EU. And the EU will be not at all open to any form of further renegotiation of the Northern Irish arrangements.
Is I'm going to add to that, that one of the reasons, surely, why unionism in Northern Ireland has lost in credibility has been its support for Brexit initially, and its hostility to the Northern Ireland Protocol, which most people in Northern Ireland welcome as being a positive development.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it is an astonishing example of a self-inflicted wound by political unionism to have supported Brexit. I mean, it has reopened the whole issue of reunification, which before the 2016 referendum was essentially a sleeping question, one for the very long grass, which is now up and centre in the debate, not just in Northern Ireland, but also in the Republic.
Quite a lot of what you've said, quite reasonably, today has been that it's too early to predict precisely the course of the Conservative Party, precisely the course of the Labour Party. But if you had to bet, do you think in 2029, a Labour Party, presumably led again by Keir Starmer, is sitting down to draw up the European aspect of its manifesto? Will it still have the red lines that it has now? Will it have some new red lines, or will it, in general, over the course of the next 4 or 5 years, evolve away from these red lines, more towards what the Conservatives and their supporters in the media say they fear, namely, rejoining the European Union?
I think rejoining the European Union will be an enormous issue at the next general election. I think British politics is far more fluid than people appreciate. This election was, in many respects, a democratic disgrace. I mean, the low turnout, the capacity to form a government with an enormous majority on a very modest vote, the distortions between the reform seat score and the Liberal Democrat seat score and all the rest, and the absence of any serious debate, not just on Brexit and on Europe and European policy and our place in the world, but on a whole range of other domestic issues too. There were no real solutions put to issues for the National Health Service or for public services more generally or for housing. I mean, it was an astonishing election, actually, a democratic disgrace. And shows the fragility of British politics. And when you add to that the possibility with a Trump presidency, with all the challenges facing Europe, the challenges of Russia and Ukraine, the challenges of the global economy, the moves towards a greater protectionism everywhere, these are very turbulent times. We have the chance of seeing, in particular, the British identity torn between an American option and a European one, that the sort of debate that we have been trying to avoid for generations because of its potentially monumentally divisive nature. These are very, very dangerous times. And to predict precisely what the political composition of and the forces will be in such circumstances, I think it is very difficult. We are in new territory here, really new territory.
Well, we'll have a lot to talk about over the next 4 or 5 years. The only thing I would say in conclusion is that I'm quite confident if the British people are presented with a choice between, crudely, the American option and the European option, it's the European option they'll go for. And that's the reason why the people who were in favor of Singapore on Thames or Dallas on Thames kept so quiet about what they wanted during the referendum, because they knew it was something that was politically unsaleable to the British electorate. But thank you very much indeed, John. There's a lot of other similar material on the Federal Trust website. And thank you very much for joining us today.